session number 10687, reel 5.
Mr. Quill, reel 5.
No, I don't think I remember in such cases, but there were plenty of very young and very inexperienced pilots in fighter command at that time, and particularly new pilots coming from OTUs, and therefore they had to be sort of, shall we say, nursed along a little bit. But in every squadron there were inexperienced and pilots, and then and experienced pilots, and so the inexperienced ones tended to be helped along in those days.
Do you remember any particular losses of commanding officers or any leading members of the squadron whilst you were there?
Well, yes, in fact, when I arrived at 65 Squadron, the squadron commander, who was a chap called Saunders, I think, I'm going to be sure of that, was lost night flying the night I arrived. And we had a few casualties, people getting shot down during our engagements. We didn't have not enormously heavy casualties. We were very lucky, I think, but we...
Did you have the sense that Britain was winning the Battle of Britain or not?
I don't think one sort of thought about it in those terms. It was... We knew that it was a pretty sort of tense affair, and I suppose we weren't necessarily confident that we were necessarily going to win the outcome, but we weren't, neither were we conscious of losing it. So I think it was just, you know, everybody was just carrying on from day to day and hoping for the best, I suppose, as outcome. I don't think we were, we weren't sort of adding up. I think the people who had the worry were the people at group headquarters and command headquarters who were really running the battle. I don't know what old Dowding thought about it, but he certainly, of course, showed every confidence.
Did he come round to 65 Squadron?
No, he seldom visited the squadrons. We never saw much of him, but we saw Keith Park every now and again, who was our AOC, and otherwise we didn't see very many people.
What impression did Park make when he came round?
Oh, well, he was a most impressive chap, you know. He was really tall, sort of lean, rather hard-looking man. In some way, he looked rather like old Monty, actually. He was that sort of a appearance, and he was a very impressive chap. And we of course thought very highly of him in 65, certainly.
Did he boost confidence when he came around?
Oh, I think so. Yes, I mean he. It did everybody a lot of good when he visited the squadron. I don't think we were lacking in confidence somehow. It's difficult to say. I don't think we were all sort of getting very glum about losing the battle or losing the war. We just sort of thought it was rather tense business, and everybody just took it as it came. we were fairly well trained, you see. It was early, very early on in the war, and we were really part of the old regular Air Force. I mean, we were sort of regulars, had been trained in peacetime, and we were just doing what we'd been trained to do and what we were paid to do, I think, and that was that.
Were you able to make any special contribution because you'd been a test pilot?
Well, I don't know. It's difficult to say. I was very... my experience of fighting against 109s was that it confirmed my previously held belief that the Spitfire was a better aeroplane, and it also confirmed a lot of things that I had, the idea of things that were wrong with the Spitfire would have to be corrected, and I was able to report back to Supermarines on a number of these things, and most of which were down. And for instance, the aileron control was very, very bad on the early Spitfires. It was much too heavy, and that was accounted for by the fact that before the war, the air staff had regarded the Spitfire as not as a dogfighter, not as a vehicle for fighting against other fighters in the air, because it was until the fall of France, we were very unlikely to meet other fighters in the air. But it was the Spitfire was regarded primarily as a bomber destroyer. It was there to shoot down bombers, which were considered to be the enemy bomber, was considered to be the main threat. And so very high level of maneuverability, particularly in the rolling plane, was not really regarded as an important factor. And so the fact that we were reporting from the early days about the bad aileron control of the Spitfire didn't worry anybody very much. That it wasn't regarded as a very high degree of maneuverability was not regarded as essential for either the Spitfire or the Hurricane, because, as I say, they were regarded as bomber destroyers. And therefore, we went into the Battle of Britain when we were, of course, faced with a whole lot of opposing fighters, which hadn't been a threat before. Because, I mean, the idea of German fighters appearing over the skies in Britain had never been taken into consideration, because it wasn't possible until the fall of France, until Germans had a lot of Ford airfields, therefore, captured in Belgium and Holland and France. Which brought their fighters within reach of the UK, and so it was a new situation to some extent. And
had you thought before the war that the increasing speed of fighters meant the end of the dogfight?
I personally didn't take that view, because I knew what you could do with the Spitfire and the Hurricane. I'd trained them both before the war, and I thought that a dogfight was a perfectly feasible situation. But a lot of the senior people in the Air Force, by over less time, they were sort of air marshals and so on, of course, their experience of fighting had been in World War One, with aeroplanes like the SE-5 and Camels and so on and so forth. And those aeroplanes had mostly a top speed of around about 120 miles an hour. And so the idea that a thing like a Spitfire, which was doing between 300 and 400 miles an hour, would be able to be used for dogfights seemed absolutely grotesque to a lot of these chaps. But in fact, of course, it wasn't at all. It was quite a feasible proposition, as we now know. And so I think that if it hadn't been for those two factors, one, the fall of France and the fall of the Low Countries, and the fact that everybody had rather written off the idea of dogfights on the sort of grounds of the high speeds involved, I think we would have paid a good deal more attention to the problems of manoeuvrability and aeron control in the years before the war. But actually, we sorted out the aerons very quickly after the Battle of Britain. But we actually fought the Battle of Britain with a terror, really abominable aeron control. And
coming back to the Battle of Britain, what did you think about the calibre of the German pilots as compared to the British pilots?
Well, I don't think we had any grounds for supposing that they were any worse than we were, or any better. I mean, apart from the fact that they had a few sort of well-known sort of aces who were obviously clocking up big scores, I don't think we thought about them as being very invincible or anything of that sort. They were just fighter pilots like anybody else, and we assumed that they could shoot, and one had to treat them with great respect. After all, you know, but we didn't think very highly, or necessarily very highly of them, or very badly of them either.
What was your attitude towards the enemy? Did you hate them, or was there a gentlemanly attitude?
No, I personally didn't. I think one didn't really think of the so much of you felt you were fighting against another aeroplane. You weren't sort of shooting a man; you were shooting an aeroplane, and so you didn't have any qualms about that. You were just keen to destroy it, and you didn't think in terms of the sort of human being inside it very much. At least I don't think I personally didn't. I don't think anybody else did much either. I think they were...
Did you ever see any of the pilots, any of their faces, or did they communicate to you in any way? Any of the enemy pilots, did you see their faces close up?
Oh, no. We never got close to see. I mean, you could see a chap's head inside a cockpit, of course, but you couldn't see any... Any expression on his face or anything like that. Mm.
Was the Battle of Britain fought in a gentlemanly or a ruthless way?
I would think it was fought in a pretty ruthless way, in a sense that, as I say, if you're encountering, say, some 109, your main preoccupation was to shoot one down, and you were trying to shoot the aeroplane. You know, you didn't say, you sort of chaps would come after an engagement into the debriefing and so on. He'd say, "I got a 109, or I got a 111, or something of that sort." He didn't say, "I got three Germans in a Dornier or something of that sort." It was a pretty ruthless battle in a largely impersonal way.
But what about things like shooting at pilots as they were descending in parachute?
Ah, well, that was a lot of people had views about that. I personally took the view that it was I could understand to some extent. The Germans shooting British people coming down. After all, a chap descending in a parachute was trying to escape. He was saving his. I mean, he's inevitably. And if he was coming down over his own country, there was. Therefore, it was reasonable to assume that as soon as he'd landed, he'd get in another aeroplane and be coming back into the battle. And I think. There was anybody who thought about it in those terms considered that it was fair game, but it was not only if that chap was over his own territory, and I think it was a very frightful thing to do in other circumstances. I mean, it was a pilot. In a parachute was completely helpless, and to just shoot him was an awful thing to do, I think, myself. That was my view, anyway.
But could you personally have brought yourself to have machine-gunned a German pilot who was descending in a parachute over his own country?
Well, I don't know. I never faced that dilemma. I doubt it. I don't think I should probably. I think I'd probably let him get away with it. The only possible, as I say, the only possible justification for doing that was if the fellow was descending over his own country, or his own territory, and was therefore likely to get in another aeroplane and as soon as he was could get and return to the battle.
Did you personally have any sense of outrage that the Germans were flying over Britain?
Yes, I think one did. I mean, I personally, I think like most other people in England and in the Royal Air Force at the time, felt that the war was entirely a thing of the Germans' making. I mean, Hitler was responsible for stirring it up, and therefore there was a very considerable amount of sort of anger involved in that. That, you know, what the hell are these bloody people doing, flying over our country and dropping bombs and so on. So there was obviously a very strong element of that sort of feeling of outrage, because the war was, had just been stirred up, as far as we were concerned, by the Germans, and we held them entirely responsible for it, and therefore we weren't going to be at all mealy-mouthed about it.
Did you feel that the fate of the country depended on what you were doing in the Battle of Britain?
No, I don't think we did at that time. I mean, I don't think we realised that the Battle of Britain was a great sort of turning point in the war, of course. But that was rather, in retrospect, one realised afterwards that if we had lost it, it would have probably lost the war. But I don't think one was quite aware of that. It was aware of it in those terms at the time of the battle. Well, it was just a battle which one had to fight, and one hoped for the best.
But did you think that the Germans would invade if we lost the Battle of Britain?
I think yes, we were well aware. I mean, there was well aware of the threat of invasion, and I suppose we realised we couldn't afford to lose the battle, and that probably invasion would result if we did. But it's rather like I think you've got to I would say that we were aware of it to some extent, but one was merely in the Battle of Britain, one was fought from day to day, and one didn't go to bed at night sort of thinking how close are we to winning or losing. One just had to go on doing it, and that was that.
So you weren't aware of making history at the time?
No, I would say not.
Do you remember Churchill's speeches in the summer of 1940? Did they make any impact?
Oh, yes, I can remember hearing his speeches, and we all thought, I think everybody in the Air Force certainly thought that Churchill was a marvellous chap, and his speeches in at the time of the fall of France and so on were really inspiring, I think. And in my view, they were. He was personally accountable. He was personally responsible for the fact that Britain went on fighting alone. God knows what would have happened if he hadn't got into power at the time that he did. He was the right man at the right time, and he was entirely responsible for Britain resisting as it did. And I think I'm afraid to say that a lot of people in the government might well have folded up and negotiated some sort of a negotiated peace if they'd been given, if Churchill hadn't kept them up to the mark.
How did you come to leave 65 Squadron and go back to test pilot work?
Well, because I was simply ordered to go back, and I had a signal from a signal arrived at Hornchurch, and one was ordered to go back. And I found out afterwards, of course, it was largely due to the excuse. I always felt that the company were rather keen to get me back, because I think they thought I was probably going to get killed. But they made the excuse that the prototype of the next Mark of Spitfire, the Mark III, which was a new experimental version of the Spitfire, was ready to fly. When I got back to the firm, of course, it wasn't damn well ready, and it wasn't ready for about 2 weeks, so I was, I think I was winkled out of 65 Squadron to some extent under false pretenses, but which rather annoyed me, but there was nothing I could do about it.
You were talking about the remedying of defects in the Spitfire in view of the experience you'd had, and you talked about the aileron control. Was there anything else which you discovered which needed rectifying?
Oh, yes, there were a number of things. That, for instance, one of the things that we had discovered during the course of test flying and duly reported on was that when you had been flying a pretty high altitude for some time, of course, the whole cockpit and the whole environment got very cold, and then particularly the inside of the windscreen, the heavy glass, armoured glass windscreen, and therefore when one dived rapidly down, you would bring this great chunk of freezing cold glass down with you, and as you descended into the warm, moist air somewhere near the ground, of course the moisture condensed on the inside of the screen and promptly froze up, and so you've got a completely opaque inside of the glass and the canopy, and that was very awkward for you, but you couldn't damn well see, and we had to develop a little sort of air blast, sort of blow high speed air at it, and that we got rid of that, solved to some extent the problem, and a number of things such as that. Can't remember what they were. I listed them all in my book somewhere, but there were also, for instance, there were a number of one of the difficulties about when you got into an engagement, you start sort of blasting away, you could then get in a situation where you weren't sure how much ammunition you'd got left. And so that was a rather uncomfortable feeling. You could perhaps join up with a couple of other aircraft or even join up with the whole squadron again after an engagement, but nobody knew how much ammunition they had. So it was difficult to... If you got involved in another engagement, it was difficult to know how whether you could shoot or not. So we tried to introduce some ammunition round counters so that you would have an indication of how much ammunition you had. But that was actually never done. But because I think the sort of environment changed, but What were the other things?
Did you actually shoot any planes down during the Battle of Britain?
Well, I claimed one or two, and they were mostly 109s, and which I knew I'd damaged severely, which I thought were very unlikely to get home. But I never actually got a flamer, as it was known. But and I also attacked a German bomber once. With a couple of other chaps, and a Heinkel 111.
Can you describe that?
Well, it was an indeterminate sort of thing. I attacked it with three other people, and we presumably did a bit of hammer. There was one engine that stopped, but. I subsequently found out from a book written by Alfred Price, who'd done a lot of research into this, and that particular aircraft didn't actually get home. It finally crashed in somewhere down near Romney Marsh, I think.
Can you tell me what memories you have of Lord Beaverbrook?
I have no direct memories of him. I mean, I only met him once, and that was during the course of the Battle of Britain. I was told to go up to London. I had a message from Sir Charles Craven, who was the managing director of Vickers in those days, but he was then seconded to the Ministry of Aircraft Production under Beaverbrook as deputy chief executive. And so I went up to, and old Craven said Beaverbrook wanted to see me, so I duly turned up, and I had no idea what it was all about, but I found out from Craven that he thought it was something to do with the installation of cannons in Spitfire, which I knew nothing about cannons, and but anyhow, I had an interview with old Beaverbrook, and it was quite interesting.
What was he like?
Well, he was a most remarkable chap, and he was. He actually wasn't there. He was operating at a tremendous pace all the time, and so when I went into his office, he decided he hadn't got time to talk to me then, so he asked me to dinner in his house that evening, and so I turned up at Stornoway House in